Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Climate Careers Podcast from Voice Academy, where we take you from climate passion to climate skills. Join us on Tuesdays to hear a new professional in the climate space share the insights you need to land your next climate role. I'm Anita Kelava, co-founder and head of marketing at Voice Academy. And today we've got Dina Prastos, who works in climate adaptation on waterfronts. This is an action-packed talk filled with mini case studies about her work on getting coastal regions in New York ready for our changing climate. I hope you enjoy it. Let's kick it off with Dina.
Anita, thank you so much for having me on today. Yes, I grew up in Anchorage, Alaska, and I probably took for granted then, but reflecting now and living in, you know, New York metro area, concrete jungle, the opportunities that I had on a, you know, daily basis to engage with nature and the values that that instilled within me. And so I grew up with a stream in my backyard. My brothers and I, every summer, we'd go camping, we'd go fishing, we'd go hiking, we'd, you know, explore. My dad was very enthusiastic and our biggest advocate to get out into nature and enjoy the outdoors. And so much of our time out of school was spent outdoors. And it really did instill this value of kind of learning what the earth offers and respecting nature's forces. When I did decide to study architecture, you know, focusing on the man-made is wonderful and the design that architects put together. But I did find myself coming back to this value of the environment and looking to work with the environment. And that's kind of how I think it shaped my career to focus on, in my case, waterfront architecture, but really climate adaptation measures through architecture.
Awesome. And could you tell us more about your work in the climate adaptation and waterfront architecture? What does climate adaptation for architecture even mean? And how do you go about architecting waterfronts? And what are some of the current projects that you're working on?
Yeah, so in my case, I studied architecture undergrad. I have a master's degree in civil engineering. And by chance, really, the first project that I started working on, and I started working on the contractor side in the field, was a waterfront project, the Staten Island Ferry Terminal. And very quickly, I mean, I spent about 2 years on the project, but very quickly, I started absorbing and learning the nuance of what it means to work on the waterfront, and whether that's as a contractor or as a designer, as an architect, as an engineer. That kind of set the trajectory for my career to continue focusing on waterfront projects. And just by default, I mean, I think engineers have specialties where they focus within civil on, you know, they have coastal engineers, they have marine engineers, they have professional engineers, divers. They get a lot deeper into what it means to work with nature's forces in very specialized arenas. Architects don't have that as much. And so for me, the typology was a geophysical one where I would focus on the waterfront, and very quickly themes of vulnerabilities emerged. And so it's not just, you know, programmatic specializations that we have in the field of architecture. It's also geophysical properties. And so the types of projects range in terms of their programmatic attributes. They're not just, you know, all commercial or all residential. There are many different types. And so for us, that means it could be a port facility. It could be a number of different types of port facilities, including things like offshore wind. It could be for maritime commerce. It could be for short sea shipping. It could be for transportation, something like a ferry landing or a ferry terminal. It could be a pier facility. It could be a waterfront park or recreational dock. And so there's so many different types of constructs found on our edge of where man-made meets nature. It's a very dynamic environment. Inherent in our due diligence and early stage processes is understanding that dynamic and that relationship with the environment. What are the tidal cycles? What are the, you know, waves, the wakes, the different ranges of motion that we're considering? And what are, you know, storm surge conditions, sea level rise projections? All of that gets embedded very early in our process, which is really the, you know, climate science coming to the fore and informing the design.
Awesome. That is so multifaceted and interesting. And I just want to learn more. You're working on the waterfront code for the New York City. So can you give us more insight on what does that mean? I know that you have a mentoring program where you're mentoring companies that are actually going to be doing more of this waterfront architecture work. So let's start with the waterfront code for the New York City and then go into the mentorship program and what are you trying to accomplish through that and why is this work so needed?
Yes, absolutely. So I'll take a step back and just look at the regulatory landscape at large of kind of what occurs on the waterfront. Where we differ a lot from other typical projects is that on the waterfront, again, inherently it is entrenched and ingrained and affected by nature as well as its ability to affect nature. And so there is a very heavy regulatory process and it happens at many different phases. And so an example of a project in New York City, you're not just going to the city to get an approval of permit and build. Far before that, often at around 30% schematic design, you're going to the state, you're going to New York State, you're going to the Department of State, the Office of General Services, you're going to the Department of Environmental Conservation. If you have an outfall, you're going to the Department of Environmental Protection. So very early on, you're engaging with regulators at different levels. At the state level, then you also deal with the federal level, the Army Corps of Engineers, especially if they're navigable waterways. There are different, we deal with NOAA, kind of different fish habitats that we look at. And so before we even get to the city level of, you know, construction drawings ready to permit, we've already gone through a very heavy regulatory review. And so there are many disconnects and it requires a lot of customization and tailoring of meetings and tailoring of responses. And there's not really an automated path. And so we look at certainly the need for our waterfront structures to have their own code and how they are different than buildings. The need is definitely there. The time is there. And so we are involved. The other thing that it enables us to do is start to think about, you look at codes kind of in general, they're very backwards looking of there's an incident that requires a, there's a safety, something that happens that threatens someone's safety, human life, human safety. And so a code is implemented. Where we have the opportunity to get ahead of that now is looking at some of our very sophisticated climate projections and understand that we're not only designing a code or writing a code right now that'll be published in adopted in 5 years and it'll affect buildings built in 10 years. And there's a lag that we can start looking at future projections of sea level rise, of climate change, and bring those into the code. And so that's what we're looking for, strategic ways to do that, or at least acknowledge that the conditions today are changing and how that can be captured in the code to have maybe a more agile code in the future.
And could you share with us a bit more on how are you thinking about climate resiliency in your project?
Yeah, so it's something I always kind of start with. Even professionals in this space, oftentimes the jargon is used interchangeably about what is sustainability versus what is resiliency and how do we embed those principles into our project and ingrain them and have them really integrated from the start. There are things that we're doing that we could do better that could enable us to not only sustain longer, but maybe have regenerative properties as well. And so that's kind of how I differentiate sustainability from resilience. And where sustainability is focused on mankind's impact on the environment, resiliency is the inverse of that, where it's the natural environment's impact on the man-made. And so they're obviously related, but where our focus and our work lies is really on the resiliency side. And again, they are related because you can build a, if it's a seawall or if you can build a sustainable seawall, you can locally source the concrete, you can look at the emissions, the carbon footprint of the materials you're using. But if you don't design that structure and construct it in a resilient way, say, for instance, it's not built to the high enough elevation and sea level rise will overtop it in 10 years as opposed to 30 years, which is, you know, the intended lifespan and design cycle, and that structure fails after 10 years, well, now you're demolishing and building new and getting all new materials and all new contractors, all new trucks on the road. Your efforts into sustainability are kind of out the window because you're doing it again because it wasn't built resiliently. And so there's that relationship. And there are, in terms of what measures we look at to apply, you know, resilient mindset, resilient strategies, resilient principles, sometimes it is, you know, a change in elevation, looking at future sea level rise projections. Sometimes it is looking at the floodproofing strategy, whether or not we want to elevate something or what maybe we don't want to elevate it, but we want to enable the water to inundate and then recede without damaging the structure. So there are a number of different ways that we look to work with nature, not necessarily always keeping it out, but acknowledging what the forces are and designing for them over whatever the period of time is that's intended.
Yeah, so you have to be very forward oriented and future facing. And so incredible work. I would like to focus on one of your projects. And I'm very excited about this one. So it's the new
Robert De Niro's new Wildflower Studios project. So could you share more about what it is, how you're working with the project? And yeah, any topics of sort of climate resiliency that you're adapting there, and how does that reflect to that particular project?
Absolutely. So the Wildflower Film Studios that are, the developer is backed by Robert De Niro. It is a vertical film studio located in Astoria, Queens, and that differs from previous film studios. Not that I'm an expert in film studios by any means. I'll describe the scope of work that we focused on, but just generally speaking, you think about the film studios out in, you know, Southern California. They have a lot of land. They're very sprawling. You think about like the golf carts that go between them. Well, in New York, we don't have that horizontal room. And so this is the first film studio of its kind that's built in a vertical system where you can have sound stages stacked on top of each other, filming simultaneously different films. And so that's the program of the building, and where it's situated is in Astoria, Queens, near JFK, off of Steinway Creek. And Steinway Creek was kind of the original door that opened for us to get involved in the project because it is a waterfront site. It had kind of a derelict waterfront of a whole lot of different structures that had failed over time and were actively eroding. And so the developer came to us and initially asked us to get involved in the shoreline rehabilitation. And so we also looked into whether or not recreational access was something that we could do. In the end, we ended up putting two different typologies in. One was a more natural shoreline that looks similar to like a riprap shoreline, different sized stones kind of stacked at a, you know, engineered slope. And then also we found remnants of a crib structure that we were able to put a gravity wall atop. So a precast gravity wall we were able to stack. And that is all facing the creek, topped with a boardwalk and a kind of a public park. And so that was our initial scope, was the waterfront, which makes sense. That's a lot of what our initial work is. But again, because our team, which is comprised of architects, engineers, planners, and different, you know, specialties therein, we have the geotechnical engineers, we have the marine engineers, coastal engineers, the dive engineers, we have naval architects, we have landscape architects, and we have climate adaptation specialists on the team. Our scope expanded into the flood mitigation strategy because it is in a low-lying property, low-lying elevation that is in a FEMA flood zone, and the compliance with New York City's Appendix G, which looks at the flood proofing, was not something that there were many other members of the team, you know, engineer and architects of record for the building structure itself. But the flood mitigation strategy wasn't top of mind for any one team member. And so that was a scope that was awarded to us, again, because of our comfort working in on with the water. We developed a floodproofing strategy, multi-pronged approach that includes a dry floodproofing strategy for areas of program that are not permitted to be wet floodproof. So dry means keeps the water out at all measures, occupiable spaces. But the majority of the site actually has a wet floodproof ground level, which is intended for parking and for storage. And then there are various means that we use to achieve the dry floodproofing, which some are, you know, floodproofing doors, some are deployable systems that are temporary in the event of an emergency. And so we worked with the engineers, structural engineers, the civil engineers, the landscape architects to come up with different strategies for the site. And again, nuance in New York, because you don't have a lot of horizontal room. One of the, you know, building sides was on the property line. There wasn't room to put even a deployable flood wall up in an emergency. And so it required some creative thinking about how different systems could come together to achieve the goal.
Hey, a very complex system and process. So I'm very thankful that the project is rolling and that you guys were able to help in there. Before we sort of discussed the mentorship program that you're doing with companies in New York City. And in that mentorship program, you're helping them become more waterfront, like focused, specific, equipped. So what does that process look like? How do you engage with other companies?
Sure. So I'll start with kind of our core values as a company. We have several companies really that we've empowered team members to step up into ownership. And so we have a women-owned entity. We have a veteran-owned entity. We have a minority-owned entity.
And that's really stemming from our experiences in the workforce where, you know, we have competent individuals, competent women, competent minorities, competent veterans that are doing the work. And we saw the opportunity to step into the specialization within this climate adaptation space and open companies that, frankly, we do a lot of government work and there are incentives for government to use minority, women, disadvantaged, veteran-owned businesses. And so we saw the opportunity for ourselves. And even as we're working in this space and we are highly specialized, there is a tremendous amount of work that, I mean, we have a tremendous amount of backlog, but there's a tremendous amount more work that needs to be done, particularly within the climate adaptation space. And much of that work is at the water's edge on the waterfront. And again, being that it is a nuanced, highly specialized part of the industry, we have teamed together. New York City Economic Development Corporation put out an RFP early in or midway through 2020 that we said, you know what, no one knows this better than us of kind of how to get your feet under you in this space. Why don't we look to lead this program and look to develop the workforce, because many of our goals are set for the state in terms of renewables and offshore wind, which requires a lot of waterfront contracting, a lot of waterfront expertise that doesn't currently exist. And so knowing the need is there, knowing we have the expertise, we bid on the opportunity and were awarded it. And so what the program is a workforce development program for businesses. And so we mentor different businesses, whether it's on the design side, on the safety side, on the engineering side, on the construction side, in this specialty space of waterfront. And we have a range of other courses that, you know, some of them kind of generic business type courses, but tailored to the waterfront in terms of, you know, liabilities and liens and different things, equipment, safety. But many of them are, you know, specialized to, you know, marine engineering, design, what to expect working on the waterfront. And so other companies that maybe are stagnating in, you know, if it's interior fit outs or whatever it is, see an opportunity to work within the climate adaptation space on the waterfront and on renewable projects.
So interesting. A lot of great, great work. I have a question more for what was your process stepping into this role? You know, we have a lot of people that are listening to our podcast that are trying to build out their career in the climate space and focus their profession more towards climate. So what are some of the tips that you would give to people that are looking to, one, build their career in this space, and two, just align maybe the career that they have more towards climate?
Sure. And I think it's probably different for everyone. So something that's helped me along my path is reframing and reasserting what my core values are and how that can be shown and demonstrated through my work. And so very early on, I finished school and I could have gone into a traditional, you know, architecture path that maybe I was working on commercial buildings or residential buildings, but, you know, maybe a programmatic type or a scale or a type of client. But for me, because I early on differentiated myself with, you know, an engineering degree, which I don't necessarily think is required for everyone, but I was looking to differentiate my skill set early and broaden my base in the industry and marry that again with my values of the environment. And so I think in my case, I was able to identify themes working on the waterfront, which for me happened by chance, but it was an avenue into work with nature, be with nature, still practice the type of work that I practice, but tailor it to a specialization that I hadn't ever, you know, formally heard of. A waterfront architect wasn't something that, you know, I could go to school and study to be. And so I very much forged my own path based on my values, based on the work, the type of work that interests me, based on the type of work that I had exposure to, and very much leaned into that. And I think anyone with similar values, you know, our planet, our environment, whatever it is that your skill set is, there are ways to marry your passions and your values into your work that can benefit the environment. And so that might not be, you know, waterfront architect. It might be, you know, a different discipline of engineer or a type of marketer. And there are different ways to, you know, flex those muscles in the arena of climate adaptation. And I would say in the renewables market in general is a growing industry. And so if you're going to bet on yourself anywhere, just generally thinking, it's wise to bet on yourself in a growing industry and not one that's, you know, shrinking or dying.
Yes, wonderful. We've had a lot of speakers come in and say, you know, you don't have to leave everything behind in order to focus on climate. You can absolutely adapt your work towards climate and to
transfer the skills that you've gained somewhere into
absolutely
that space. So yes, thank you for that. Thank you so much. This has been an awesome interview, and I'm looking forward for our audience to get a listen.
And that's it from us. Thanks so much for listening. Remember to follow on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. You can learn more about Voice Academy and our upcoming courses on upskilling into the climate space at voice.academy. That's voiz.academy. And if you want to support the podcast, share it with someone else who's passionate about this space.